From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Think about humankind's great leaps forward when millions were lifted from poverty to some kind of prosperity. Usually there was a key ingredient. Often it was about communication, telegraph, railroad, telephone. Today, that change agent is the internet. Trouble is, most of the world's people still have little or no access to it, to its commerce, its education, to all the world's knowledge there. 4 billion people not in the game. The White House now calls it a core utility, the internet. Some go further, call it a human right. This hour On Point, the global digital divide and its implications. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What does it mean in this internet age not to be online? And should internet access be up there with clean water, food, education for prosperity? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Last July, President Obama spoke with students of Durant High School, Durant, Oklahoma, about his administration's plan to bring more internet to low-income communities. The internet, he said, is not a luxury.
In this digital age, when you can apply for a job, take a course, pay your bills, order pizza, even find a date by tapping your phone, the internet is not a luxury, it's a necessity. You cannot connect with today's economy without having access to the internet.
Not a luxury, a necessity for connection to today's economy, says the President of the United States. And here, another rather prominent figure in the internet world, Mark Zuckerberg, in Delhi, in India last year, talking about internet connectivity and saying it's a human right.
We believe that connectivity is a human right, and that connectivity and getting connectivity for the world is one of the fundamental challenges of our generation.
A new UN report says more than half the world is not connected, not there. Joining me first today from Cape Town, South Africa, is Indra Delanerol. He's a visiting researcher at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. He's head of the Network Society Project, which tracks the development of the internet and its social and economic effects in Africa. He's also a partner in the World Internet Project, researches internet use across the globe. Indra, great to have you via Skype and a fast internet connection from Cape Town. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're well. This UN report got our attention, and then the White House comes out and says, this is a utility, a core utility. I wonder if you just walk with us a little bit through some of the findings of this UN report that just came out last week. It says that the growth in people with access to the internet, the numbers of them is slowing. The saturation levels practically in rich economies, but 90% they found of people in the 48 poorest countries in the world don't have access to the internet, that the growth in access is slowing from double digits for a long time until just 8.1% a year, and that this UN goal of having 4 billion internet users out there by 2020 is not going to be met. What do you take from this report, Indra, about the state of global access and the digital divide?
Well, I think what the report shows is that the technologies, the cables, if you like, of the internet, the railway tracks, they are slowly spreading to almost every corner of the world. But what's not spreading is use and affordability. So one of the problems we see in a number of countries is that even where the physical infrastructure exists, people can't actually afford to use it. And then the other problem is what kind of internet. So in the US, your government and the regulator are concerned about speeds. And and they're worried about places like South Korea, where the norm is 100 megabits per second, which is very fast, but they're moving to maybe 1 gigabit per second, 10 times faster than that. And meanwhile, in America, most people have much lower speed. So there's a sort of global speed up of the people who are connected, and they're getting richer and richer services. And then there's people who are, of course, the majority not on at all. And then even a majority of the people on, especially in poorer countries or even middle-income countries, are on something that wouldn't be probably acceptable to you and wouldn't let us to have this conversation now.
What about these characterizations? The White House calling this now a core utility should be seen as on a par with water, electricity, sewerage. Mark Zuckerberg going even further, and others as well, saying that this connectivity should be seen as a human right. What do you make of that? Is it now so important to really participating, to having a shot at prosperity, that it should be in those categories?
Yeah, I think the utility point's interesting because it speaks to a sort of paradox. A generation or two ago, I don't think you could have said that, and the technology hasn't changed. What has changed is that so much of the world and so much of the world of power and economics, business, jobs is now inextricably linked with these services. So as most of the economy and most of society moves onto it, if you're left out of it, that becomes more and more of a problem. So, for example, I was in Kenya a while ago speaking to a guy in a village. He'd been using the internet. He'd been using things like Facebook for a couple of years, but he'd only just got an email address. The reason he'd got an email address was because he wanted to look for new jobs. And he knew that really writing letters and things just wasn't going to work, even in Kenya, in a rural area. He now needed to be online. He needed to communicate via email because he needed to look for jobs. So, and we see that in lots of countries, that the technology has just become part of normal life in the formal economy amongst middle classes and rich people, and therefore to be left out of that becomes a real hindrance and becomes a massive inequality issue.
The UN set this goal of 4 billion people on the internet by 2020. It now looks very likely that will not be met. Over 3 billion on now, 4 billion still not on, their latest numbers say. What are the implications of that? If that gap stays over time, there's already so much conversation about inequality in the world. Do we build in a kind of a structural, uncrossable divide there? Are you confident it will eventually bleed through the whole population, or do we split into the connected population and other?
It's a very good question. I think most people are not on. Most people are really failing. Even those who are getting on are finding it very difficult to use in the way you would use it. So we look at it as a kind of rationed internet world that they live in. And the implications of that get worse and worse for some of the reasons I was saying, because you're in a way missing out on more and more. I think that it's not a static thing. I mean, the growth is coming down, according to the ITU figures in that UN report, but it is still growing. And in fact, what we see is that these technologies improve all the time, and the costs of the technologies change. So one big change that's happened over the last few years is that the cost of devices, mobile devices, mm-hmm. I'm talking really about mobile phones, keep on falling. And actually that makes the networks more and more accessible. So there's quite a lot of good news. And this is still, as the report says, I mean, if you think about it in the history of any technology spreading globally, this is still by no doubt the fastest technology ever to have spread, compared to the telephone, the radio, even mm-hmm. if you think of printed books. These things took generations to spread across the world and stayed with, of course, large numbers of people not getting those things. But the internet has grown at a rate that surpasses all of those, and it is still growing. And also, we know a lot about what it takes to grow further. I mean, the reasons, yes, it's saturated in the West, in the global North, that's why some of those figures are slowing down. In the global South, it's still growing. The barriers, we know that primarily the number one barrier is affordability, and we know, in fact, how to fix that. So these are very addressable problems. I mean, it's a bit like, and I think the utility point is a good one, you know, we know how to get water to people, we know how to get electricity to people. If we don't, it's because of economic and political considerations that it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. Engineers know how to get the job done.
We should be very clear about what the UN report says. It's interesting. It says broadband internet, failing to reach billions of people living in the developing world, including 90% of those in the poorest nations. I mean, you've got the most connected countries, South Korea, with the world's highest broadband penetration, 98.5% of homes connected. Qatar, 98%. Saudi Arabia, 94%. The U.S. up there in the 80%. But at the lowest level, these are what they call the least developed countries, LDCs, less than 2% of the populations in Guinea, Somalia, Burundi, Eritrea, and lots of others where it's down in that 10% range. People saying this can't remain or we're going to be on two tracks that just don't meet. Do you trust these numbers, Indra?
I trust them in the rich world. I don't trust them in the middle income and poor world. To be honest, as with all numbers about in poorer parts of the world, it's very difficult to do numbers properly. And the ITU publish these figures each year, and we examine them, and they are, in general, I'd say most of these numbers, if anything, are overstated or optimistic. So the real numbers are often probably worse. We did, for example, surveys in 2012 in 12 African countries. In Ethiopia, for example, 3% we found of the population were using the internet. And Ethiopia is the third biggest population on the continent.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the global digital divide, the billions of people globally without internet access, and what happens with them as the internet becomes the baseline tool for prosperity, education, awareness, connection. Indra de Lannerol is with us from the University of Zwitserland in Johannesburg, joins us today from Cape Town. He's head of the Network Society Project, tracking social and economic effects of the internet in diffusion in Africa. Of course, you've got big businesses with big interests here. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg calls it a human right, a top human right. Bill Gates responded to that a couple of years ago. Of course, he's done a lot of work on malaria, called that a joke as a priority. What's more important, he asked, connectivity or malaria vaccine? But think about prosperity, says Mark Zuckerberg. Here he was last February, talking about the internet, prosperity, and the connection.
There are all these studies that show that in developing countries, more than 20% of GDP growth is driven by the internet. There have been studies that show that, you know, if we connected a billion more people to the internet, there would be 100 million more jobs would be created, and more than that would be lifted out of poverty. So, you know, there's just this deep belief here at Facebook that technology needs to serve everyone.
Of course, Facebook would think that. Indra de Lannerol, please stand by in Cape Town, South Africa. Katie Pierce joins us now from Seattle, Washington, assistant professor, Department of Communication at the University of Washington. Looks a lot at technology all over the world. Katie Pierce, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
All right. Thanks, Tom, for having me.
When you see these big numbers come out of the UN, 57% not online, 4.2 billion without broadband internet access, what are you thinking? What's going through your mind, Katie?
Well, when we see these reports come out, and they come out annually, globally, we have the domestic reports that come out in the U.S. Mm-hmm. We see them come out from the U.N. I'm glad that organizations and agencies are heightening the issue, but these numbers aren't that meaningful. As Indra already mentioned, it's very difficult to collect this sort of data, especially in more difficult environments and low-income countries. Moreover, when we think about just these numbers, the percentage of people that access the internet, one big challenge there is that that's usually measured by ever accessed. And so in our minds, when we think about internet use, we think about, as Americans, the way that we use the internet. We're online, connected all day long on mobile devices, yeah, computers at work. And when we hear that a certain percentage of people in a country are using the internet, that's counting grandpa that got on Skype once. And he's being put in the same category as the 19-year-old university student that's wired all day long.
Yeah.
And so
that's how it
that's
hits our
really
ear anyway. That's how we view it. So in a way, these numbers may even exaggerate who's on. I mean, let me give you a sense, and you, Indra, as well, there in South Africa, our listeners here around the country, around the world, responding. Rosemarie says, you know, I'm online with a subsistence farmer in Benin at the end of the most remote trails. You can buy gas, food, and cell phone in minutes. So it's got to be about politics, she says. Others kind of skeptical about the whole thing, you know. Rick says cyber criminals, perverts, and Zucks, as in Zuckerbergs, licking their chops over a feeding frenzy. Here's another listener says, by the time these billions get connected, the U.S. and whatever other world power will already have found ways to monitor everything they do online in the name of security. So are they really better off online? And then Brett says, is lack of access unwittingly encouraging the ever-expanding plutocracy, therefore the critical income divide? Katie, what about Mark Zuckerberg and others point at this and say, if you don't have universal or something like it internet access, you're going to have not just a digital divide, but a real income divide, a prosperity divide. Do you buy that?
Well, I think that there is a lot of evidence that once particular communication technologies get into people's hands, that gaps between rich and poor are exacerbated. And that isn't just with income, that once you are that this is the opposite of leveling the playing field, that those who are already privileged are skilling up more quickly. So, for example, if you think of low-income and high-income schools in the U.S., if the high-income children are already getting better exposure, more extracurricular activities, and they also have access to this technology, the gap widens. And so I think that Mark Zuckerberg has a really good point there. I agree with you, though, that despite the speech where he says, you know, this is really an important thing to Facebook, it is. It's about business for them in the end.
Indra, talk to us about how people are, in fact, accessing the internet, when and if they do. Let's say in South Africa, sub-Saharan Africa more widely. I mean, we're reading so many stories about how important it's becoming there. Lots of banking being done online in Africa and a lot more. So people are accessing it somehow. I assume that the mobile must be the number one way these days.
Yeah. So, in fact, the number of computers around is still very, very low. And hasn't been going up. So there's many more internet users than there are PCs. And so this is all, not all, but most of the growth is from people using their mobile phones. And one thing that, as I was saying about the phone, cost of these phones changing over time, they're now around $50. You can get an Android smartphone. So they're becoming more affordable. I think on this question I get from, you know, some of the texts you're getting, this issue of saying, well, you know, how can it be as important as things like food or water, and you know, how can it be prioritized? And the Bill Gates response to Mark Zuckerberg when he launched his internet.org project to try and connect more people. Of course, malaria will say, you know, doing something about malaria tomorrow will save more lives than connecting people. But I think to put it the other way around, if we look at how poor people in poorer countries actually behave, so they're making their own decisions based on the context that they know very well,
yep.
They put a big priority on communication, a priority that actually even the companies that first built the mobile networks in the 90s, beginning in the 90s in Africa, had no idea how many of them would want to use this technology. They built their businesses assuming that the majority of the population would never want to use these technologies, and they were wrong. And so people actually sacrifice buying other things in order to use them. And that is not, I think we shouldn't assume, you know, people are being dumb. People are making rational choices because communication is so important for almost anything you want to do. I mean, we've mentioned jobs and the economy. Safety, when we ask people why, what are the things you value about your mobile phone, or what are the things you value about being able to get online? One of them is, I know where my family is that way. I know that they're okay. In an emergency, I know they can get hold of me. So there are just a whole bunch of things that people in countries like the US can take for granted, which in many countries of the world, you can't take for granted. And I think the other thing is that if you're living in a rich country, the internet was an additional communication channel. You had many others. You had news on television and newspapers. Mm-hmm. You had phone calls. You had all these other things. And then you got the internet. So it can feel like a luxury because you managed without it. But actually, what I find all the time is that, you know, the internet is it. There is nothing else. So, for example, that guy I was talking to you about, who was trying to get a job by writing mm-hmm. emails, mm-hmm. he was living in a village only a couple of hours out of a major city, but no newspaper had ever been delivered to that village. So the first time he used Facebook, not to chat to his friends, although he also did that, he used it as his daily means of getting the news. He could get to the newspaper via the internet, although the newspaper didn't get to him as a physical paper. So I think people can underestimate how widely important it is in people's lives when you've got other options, living in a better resourced and communication rich environment.
Katie, if I may, there in Seattle, what's the difference you see if access is via mobile or via PC or laptop, a kind of a bigger format that a lot of Americans have long used? I'm only going to mobile now, but if mobile is the poor nation way to the internet, is it the same or a comparable experience? Is it still the economic key?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because often we see, a way to resolve digital divide issues is via mobile. And mobile phones, smartphones are getting better all the time in terms of the things that you can do. But Steve Jobs in 2010 used a really nice metaphor when he talked about how early on in the development of automobiles were all trucks because we were agrarian, we needed to haul things. Mm-hmm. But as automobiles became more common in cities, cars became more popular. People didn't need all the functionality of a truck. And so Steve Jobs was talking about if tablets could replace PCs. And he said, personal computers are like trucks. We still need them around. And they're still valuable, but not everyone needs them. I would argue that we need to talk about who has the keys to the trucks. If PCs,
you're losing me a little bit in the metaphor there. What does it mean?
So if PCs are where certain things need to be done, for example, mm-hmm. programming, editing a professional level movie, if those certain tasks absolutely require a PC to do, then we are denying people the ability to do those creative pursuits. No one's going to write the next great app on their $50 Android smartphone. So even though mobile internet is great, smartphones are great, we can't view it as a replacement globally or in the US for some of the tasks that are much easier and sometimes require a keyboard, mouse, and a screen to do.
Indra, talk about the way this is rolling out in many areas. Yes, you can get cut from PC to mobile, but there's a further cut here as well. You've got companies like Facebook coming in to address maybe the affordability issue, but offering what is really not the internet. They'll give you free Facebook or free Facebook plus Wikipedia via your mobile, but not the full internet access that we're accustomed to in the U.S.
Yes, I think it's interesting to think about the ways these digital divides are moving in a way, in a very dynamic way. So I think Katie's got a very important point about mobile devices, but I'd add mobile networks. So, for example, in most African countries, it's not just about that you need to use a mobile phone. That's probably the only device you've got. But it's also that the only network you've got is the mobile networks. So if you think of, your life in Boston, you can probably get on a fixed line at work, a fixed line at home, via, Wi-Fi, but it's got cables. Mm-hmm. Your buildings are connected to cables. And even if you think of the public Wi-Fi that you might have in a Starbucks or whatever, that's also actually connected to cables. And in African context, South African context, and most countries, actually probably not. You're probably relying on mobile networks. And in general, globally and in Africa, mobile is very, very expensive way of buying data, of paying for the internet. So that's why if there's one thing holding back access, it's the cost of data, and especially the cost of data on mobile networks. So that's proving another kind of divide. If you can get hold of a fixed line, then you can get cheaper data. But actually the poor, and this is true both of poor countries versus rich countries, but it's also true of poor people versus mm-hmm. rich people within poor countries, pay more for the internet than rich people pay.
Because they're accessing via mobile. Katie Pierce in Seattle, one of the ways that countries look to get around that, or companies do, is by offering essentially free access, zero rating, it's called. But very often that may just give you not the whole internet, but just Facebook or Facebook plus Wikipedia. I've been looking here at a headline from Quartz saying Facebook's plan is to find its next billion users, convince them the internet and Facebook are the same thing. Katie, what's going on there?
Well, the zero rating idea sounds nice on the surface. Wow, how great that Facebook is offering itself for free. But it becomes a walled garden. And more importantly, it ends up prioritizing those sites that can afford to provide themselves for free over other resources. So, for example, imagine a local women's organization has a blog and a website. They can't afford to offer access to their site for free. And so Facebook wins. At the same time, it is true that around the world, a lot of people are on Facebook for the majority of their internet use. And that's fine. They're interacting with friends. They're getting news. But we don't want to set up a system where accessing resources beyond a for-profit social networking site is impossible.
I mean, we talk a lot in this country about net neutrality, but you're describing something there where Facebook may be all you get or nearly all you get, even though it's free.
Yes, and this is nothing new. Social networking sites have been making these agreements with providers in developing countries for a long time. And it's interesting because you can see the trends in terms of the most popular sites based on when they offer zero rating, or sometimes they'll do it in exchange for advertising, that it's essentially, you know, like when you go to an airport sometimes and you have to watch an ad before you can get on the airport Wi-Fi. But that is how access works in a lot of places.
How widespread is that in your neck of the woods, Indra, in South Africa and beyond? This free access, but all you get is maybe Facebook, Wikipedia, I don't know, some search.
Yeah, so if you think about these models, I mean, Facebook doesn't charge to use Facebook. So the issue is really about the operators, or the ISPs, as they're called, the service internet service providers, whether they're charging you as a customer for data. And what we find, not just in African countries, also in Latin America, and to some extent in some Asian countries, is zero ratings one model, where the operator decides to actually not charge for data for some limited services. The other thing we find in Colombia, the first time I saw it actually was about 3 or 4 years ago in Colombia, in Latin America, where mobile operators were selling packages. So you could, instead of selling a package to connect for the month or the day, you could buy different packages of services. So you could buy YouTube, or you could buy Facebook plus WhatsApp, or you could buy a different package of services. Now that makes the internet rather more like cable television.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the global digital divide, the billions of people globally without internet access, and what happens with them as the internet becomes increasingly the baseline tool for prosperity, education, awareness, connection. Katie Pierce joins us from the University of Washington in the Department of Communication there. Indra Dilanarol is with us from Cape Town, South Africa, visiting researcher at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, head of the Network Society Project. Mark Zuckerberg talks a lot about this. Of course, Facebook. It all depends on big numbers, so the more the merrier. Here he was in Delhi, in India, last year, talking about internet.org. Facebook and a consortium of tech companies have launched it. India has lifted millions out of poverty, he told his audience. He said, you've got some of the world's best engineers. You've sent a probe to Mars, and indeed they have. Now, he told his audience there, you need to get the internet to all your people.
Now, the next generation here has the opportunity to define the future and bring India to the world and the world to India. And a key to this next big opportunity is going to be embracing the internet. Because if you embrace the internet, you can transform lots of people's lives.
Transform lives. Zuckerberg has an interest in that, but maybe we all do. The White House in a new report calling the internet now a core utility, like water, like electricity. What it means, though, to have it means different things all over the world. In South Africa, you can get something widely used there called Cell C. You get Facebook and some other things, but everything? Not really. Here's an ad for internet.org from Cell C. It's this mobile provider in South Africa bringing free Facebook and more to South Africa.
Hlangana ku Facebook for free with Cell C. It's so easy to set up. Visit www.internet.org or you can SMS internet to 30080 to get the link sent to your phone and launch free Facebook. You also get free access to job sites, education, news, sports, and loads more.
Facebook for free with Cell C. But is it the internet or something else? Katie, Indra, please stand by. Laura is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. So here in Des Moines, you know, the connectivity is pretty good because we're in a bigger city. But mm-hmm. I know that our rural areas of Iowa and other parts of the Midwest are, I think, not as nearly as well connected as they should be. And I just wonder if that's something that it almost seems like to correlate with, you know, like Minnesota. Rural Minnesota is doing a lot better than we are, and they have a more progressive legislature and governor. And I just wonder if our governor, Governor Branstad, being a Republican, if this doesn't seem to be real top on the list for a lot of Republicans. I don't hear them talking about it on the campaign trail, for that matter. And I'm just wondering what your guests have to say about rural America.
It's a great question right here in the United States. Katie Pierce, what about it? The politics and the practicalities of extending internet access in this country. Who's driving it or paying for it? Who's taking it into rural areas where that last mile can be quite expensive, or I don't know, urban areas where there's not the money, perhaps? What's going on there, Katie?
Yeah, so it's Laura hits the nail on the head that it sometimes is really a political issue. Certainly, the availability of high-speed internet is dependent on the business case, that it's not worth it necessarily for a telecommunications company to provide internet in rural areas. And so it needs to be incentivized through federal or state funding. And so this broadband report that came out from the White House, it's the Broadband Opportunity Council, mm-hmm. That looked at what are the things that can be done at the federal level in terms of attracting broadband investment and specifically in rural areas and low-income urban areas? And they made a number of recommendations, and one of which was really asking local governments to step up. It's interesting because we've seen in the U.S. that actually internet access in terms of these penetration rates has really flattened out over the last 8 or so years. We now know that 84% of American adults have ever used the internet. And so who are those last 16%? Well, they're older, they're rural, they're low income, they're more likely to be African American or Native American. And so, again, those who aren't accessing are people who are already experiencing inequality, and so we don't want to see an amplification.
How does the distribution compare to what we did with telephones or electricity? I mean, there were big programs for both of those, the rural electrification push. Telephones companies were required to make it universal, weren't they?
Yeah. And so now when we look at the thing that's been interesting about the internet is that it's been treated quite differently than older forms of telecommunication in terms of telephone lines. And so because of that, because it depends on the business case, it's been really problematic. But even in places like I imagine where Laura lives, most Americans only have one option for an internet service provider, maybe two. And so when Comcast, for example, or Time Warner is your only choice, even for people that have good broadband access, you're paying a lot. And so this is not just an issue about people having no access, but also people with access not having a lot of choices. Untangling this is going to be very difficult. And I even was looking. The FCC disagrees with President Obama and this Broadband Opportunity Council in terms of the internet being a utility. The FCC thinks that this is really a terrible way to look at the internet.
I think it's interesting because, in fact, there are two globally... There are two models that seem to work really well. Mm-hmm. One is the sort of South Korea example, where effectively the state, I mean, it was mostly done by the national telephone operator, okay, but under very sort of direct control or direction of the state, simply just does everybody. I mean, South Korea has...
And that's how they get to 98.5%.
Yes. Now, I mean, South Korea has some geographic things to its advantage. It's relatively, the population's relatively dense. There's mm-hmm. quite a lot of people living in high-rise buildings and mm-hmm. things like that. But nonetheless, they just, you know, did it by kind of direction from the center. The other is where you have very, very competitive markets. And we see this in Africa. There are some countries, some of them in East Africa, where there's very competitive markets. And actually what happens there is the market does eventually deliver to a huge number with competition, to Katie's point, because the US has had actually, because of cable being such an important part of the picture, mm-hmm. and cable is not competitive, so most people often only have one choice, it's not very competitive, and that means both at the level of quality of service and the cost, the US hasn't kept up with some countries. But I think it's really that choice. So Australia, for example, has a huge national program run by the state, which they're it's very, very expensive. So they're having political problems working out how to do this, but that's their way of forward. And other countries where you have competition, where you don't have, where you have weaknesses in either of those things, you end up either with very expensive services or with the kind of last 20% not being catered for.
98% penetration in South Korea, 98% in Qatar, 94% in Saudi Arabia, 80-something in the U.S., down in the 2% range in Somalia, Burundi, Eritrea. And, of course, in the 80-something range, that means a lot of Americans left out, even here. What does that mean? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Ronald is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Ronald. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. This is Ronald. I live in Lexington, Kentucky, and I wanted to ask your callers and interviewers. I'm a traveling nurse, and I've traveled through West Virginia, Ohio, Kentucky, and the Midwest. A lot of those areas do not have broadband, but yet our states count broadband as access to either satellite, via broadband through satellite, which has extreme limitations from gigabyte to latency issues. Mm-hmm. And also they count broadband as a cell phone, you know, where you can get broadband over a cell phone signal.
Yes.
Like a Wi-Fi cannon via Verizon. Well, the problem is that those forms of broadband have limitations like 10 gigabytes per month, which doesn't work if you have a business. Or
so when you go, when you get 30 miles outside a city in your neck of the woods, Ronald, what do you find?
Well, like you said, I live in Lexington. You can go 20 to 35 minutes into little areas like, Cynthiana, Claysville, Maysville, and certain areas in the farmlands. Mm-hmm. And you can go very short distances, and the only form of broadband, if you even have access to it, would be something like a cell phone broadband that offers 10 gigabytes. That is if you're even close to a cell phone tower. And then, of course, the only thing you're left to is telephone dial-up, which, you know, is not effective for today's world. Even if you're like me, raising some kids,
yes,
they would have a 25 megabyte report, a PowerPoint presentation to send in,
mm-hmm.
or a 1 gigabyte update to Microsoft Word. A 1 gigabyte update on dial-up would take, I think, almost 6 hours, 10 hours.
Yeah, it gets very, very practical, very real in a hurry, and we're not just talking Burundi here. Ronald, I appreciate your call from Lexington, Kentucky. We're looking at the global digital divide, and of course, it's right here in this country as well. And here's a commercial from Comcast promoting their what they the service called Internet Essentials, targeted at low-income families in the U.S. from Comcast.
At school, they talked about the digital divide, the gap between people who can access the Internet and those who can't, the haves and the have-nots. Well, today, my family becomes one of the haves.
Internet Essentials from Comcast offers low-cost computers and Internet to lower-income families. It's part of our commitment to making sure that no one gets left behind in the communities we serve.
Katie Pierce in Seattle, what are the limits of our commerce will do the work approach here? Do we have to count on that? Is it getting the job done to our underserved communities?
Well, as Ronald pointed out, it's not getting the job done. And it's creating situations where people have to be very creative about how they're going to monitor their use, which is something that people all over the world do. And we have to ask, as this, especially in the U.S., becomes a very important part of operating, do we need to view internet access and decent broadband, not these, you know, bubblegum toothpicks, mm-hmm. trying to pull things together to hop internet into rural areas? It's essential. And so when today to apply to colleges has to take place online, to do financial aid applications, that we would not want someone to feel like, oh, well, you know, I can't get online to do my financial aid application for college,
yep.
because my internet's run
Won't
out.
Cut it. Is that what the White House pushing towards something more than what we're doing now when it describes internet broadband as a core utility? Are they setting us up for a change or just happy talk?
I don't think that they could make it happen. There's too much business interest. The FCC has taken a fairly firm stand on this. I think that the White House has decided that trying to have state-level initiatives and local initiatives and creative solutions is going to be the only way to patchwork things in. And some of the initiatives that they've had are really great. But in the end, I think it is going to be up to cities and communities to find solutions. Here in Seattle, there's a really great initiative at the public libraries where people can rent for free a 4G modem for your house for the month. And you check it out like you would a book,
yep.
or a video.
Mm-hmm.
Initiatives like that make a lot of sense. And that's being done by the local community.
Take it home for a month. Maybe then you do your college application. But then another month comes. Beth in Ames, Iowa. Beth, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My thoughts are leaning more not globally, but just local, I mm-hmm. believe, at this mm-hmm. point. And the television model where you have over-the-air local channels versus cable that you purchase, can something like this be applied to broadband, where everyone would have access to be able to do their homework projects or job searches or connection to family, be them in the world or wherever they are.
Beth, our time is short. Let me put it to Katie Pierce. Could we, Katie, just blanket the country with a broadband internet signal, something comparable to TV, or is it practically impractical?
Well, I think it's technically possible, but would be quite challenging to do. And what I fear is that it would become essentially a two-tiered system, and that chances are that there would be the slow public service internet, and then you'd have your pay-to-play internet, mm-hmm. and that we'd see gaps. between the two. It would be really, really challenging. It would be like what we see right now with mobile versus plugged-in broadband.
Indra, even when people have broadband, it can mean different things. We just got a few seconds here, but China's now talking about terabyte baseline for broadband internet. That's way more than in the U.S.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the. Unfortunately, I think Katie's right, but I think that's already happening. I mean, there are tiers of the internet. We talked about it when we're thinking about, you know, only getting some services, and we get it when we look at different levels of service. But I think there are real opportunities to the caller's point about, for example, one of the strategies here in one of the cities is free public Wi-Fi, capped. So it's very fast, but after 200 megs, you get cut off for the day. But it's free. It's like a minimum level of service. And to think about that utility point, I thought it was interesting with your phone callers, because they're all describing the internet as something that is a utility. They just need it in day-to-day life.
Maybe they're right on it. Indra Dilanaral in South Africa, Katie Pierce in Seattle, Washington. Thanks to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.